Welcome to the Art Scene, presented each week by UALR Public Radio. This time each year, I look forward to meeting two of the current graduating class from the Clinton School of Public Service. This is the 10th class since the first in 2004. That year, I had guests before the course had begun. Three came, two students, escorted by Senator Pryor, Jean-Pierre Bechelot and Greg Holyfield, and then two more students as graduates, Erica Hall and Jennifer Flowers. In the years since, there's been a wonderful mix of backgrounds and countries. This year, both my guests, Anne Haley and Jennifer Guzman, are from Little Rock, so I've changed the format somewhat by describing what relates to each one, then asking them what these past intense months have meant to them. First, Jennifer Guzman. She was born in Florida, moved to Little Rock when she was 12, went to Little Rock schools, and graduated from the University of Arkansas Little Rock with a degree in French and International Studies. She chose Cambodia for her international service. Her public service interests include education, hunger relief, and international security policy. Jennifer's team-based project in Arkansas was developing English as a second language, linking with a partner organization, Literacy Action in Central Arkansas. Jennifer was selected for the McClarty Global Fellowship with Vital Voices Global Partner for fall 2015. She is also the inaugural recipient of the B.A. Rudolph Scholarship at the Clinton School. Then Anne Haley grew up in Little Rock, is a graduate of Randolph-Macon Women's College with a degree in political science and studio art, after which she took a few years off, away from school and classes, worked for the Human Rights Campaign and for U.S. Senator Blanche Lincoln. She chose Manila for her international public service project, working with community and family services. So both students spent time in the Orient. Her team-based project in Arkansas worked in neighborhood rehabilitation of older homes in downtown Hot Springs, and also went to the Clinton Global Initiative University in Miami in 2015. So your thoughts of these past months. What drew you here at the Clinton School? What satisfaction lift your spirits going into the future? Jennifer Guzman.
I decided to come to the Clinton School not only because of the public service aspect, but the field service and the hands-on experience that we as students get and that they advertise, and additionally the International Public Service Project. So I think those two things combined were the biggest draw for me. And in terms of being able to give back through these hands-on activities was really important as well.
Had you done any kind of hands-on in those 2 years that you took off?
Not necessarily. I was an elementary school teacher at Forest Park. I taught French and Spanish, so that was mostly my focus. But I was kind of trying to figure out specifically what area I wanted to go in. And I think that ending up at the Clinton School is what really helped me narrow down what I want to do career-wise.
How about you, Anne?
So I had about eight years between undergrad and when I started at the Clinton School. And I was the opposite. I did not want to go back to school. And I did a lot of different things. I worked for Senator Lincoln for a while in D.C. I worked on the Obama campaign. I went back to school, actually, to UALR and took several graphic design classes because I wanted to get into that. And I did that for a little bit in the corporate sector, working for an advertising firm. And all along, I'd stayed active with my various, like, way too many things, kind of volunteering activities and clubs and that sort of thing. And specifically the Girl Scouts. Mm-hmm. I'm a literal card-carrying lifetime member of the Girl Scouts. I was working with them continually, and I just kind of realized that what I was doing in the corporate sector really wasn't fulfilling what I wanted to be doing, you know, what I needed to be doing to be happy, I guess. And so I decided to go back to the school because I wanted to have, I felt like I needed this skill set to be able to work in the field that I wanted to. And I thought the school offered that. And I knew that it was going to give me some great connections and give me the opportunity to meet some really incredible leaders in the field, and that would be, and the, you know, on the ground experience. I wanted to be able to feel when I graduated that I could do anything and not have to enter at the entry level And I feel that way now, for sure.
So you weren't drawn into politics, having been in contact with political activities for a while?
You mean as a candidate, like running?
No, but as a definite supply, performer behind the scenes, as it were.
So I'm leaving. When I'm finished with school, I'm actually going to work with the Hillary Clinton presidential campaign. So I can't say I've completely gotten it out of my system, but I think I understand now how I can find what my purpose in the intersection between the two, which is.
So that sounds like a rather broad scope for both of you.
Yeah.
Did you get abroad? You did a bit. One of you got to Manila?
Yeah, that was me.
That was you. And you were down at Colombia, was it?
No. Cambodia.
Cambodia, mm-hmm. Cambodia. And did you find that that enhanced what you were looking at as a final goal, going to the Far East and the parts of the world that you needed to, that you hadn't done up until that point?
I was lucky. I'd actually had a fair amount of experience in Southeast Asia. My family lived there for a while I was in college, so I'd travel there recreationally a lot to visit them. But I'd never been to the Philippines before, and it was really fantastic to see on the ground how an operation with a massive UN budget that they have, how on the ground, like how they actually make it work. And it kind of sparked more of an interest in, operational efficiency. And I kind of stuck with the communication side of the work that I'd been doing previously to entering the Clinton School. So it was an interesting experience to kind of apply that in that setting, mm-hmm. which was pretty great.
So now you've come to the closing days of your days at the Clinton School. Had you got to know each other quite well as a result of both having a similar interest, if not quite the same approach?
Yeah, definitely. I think, as you mentioned, I was in Cambodia for my international project, which was a wonderful experience. And after I finished and after Anne finished her project, we actually met up and took a backpacking trip through the Thai Islands. And, the school in general, there's a really close-knit sense of community, and we get to interact with our classmates on a daily basis. So we form these connections and these bonds that will last us past the Clinton School. So we've definitely gotten to know each other very well, and I'm very glad that we have.
Yes, that's great. Did you meet many of the older grads that have stayed or come back and visit from time to time and get a chance to talk to them?
Yeah, we have a pretty great network that because they were still such a small community, mm-hmm. we've only had so many graduates from the program, and we're in only class 10. So, it's pretty informal at this point. I mean, everybody knows each other, so it's mm-hmm. I know so and so is here. Then I'm going to DC. I can set up an interview or meeting there, which is helpful.
You don't have the big generational gaps that would eventually, presumably.
Well, I mean, we've got a pretty diverse yeah. class. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've got...
all kinds of people.
We've got a pretty wide age range in our own class. I'm a little bit on the older end of the kind of... the millennial generation that's in our class. But we've got a couple who are seasoned professionals that mm. have returned to school.
But that's useful, because if you're all looking at the top of the list is service. Mm-hmm. And so there are many different pathways that lead you there. And some of you might be meeting ones that aren't attached to your particular class, but have got into the field. And mm-hmm. just talking to them might have the odd handle that mm-hmm. would answer a question that you'd had in mind. And, of course, they bring in so many good speakers that you have a chance to talk to some of them as well.
Absolutely.
On a much more informal one-on-one case, which in itself is worth $1,000 a day or less, yes. when you get to be talking to people who have achieved a lot.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And I was just thinking, because it is such a... when you see it written down, it sounds sort of husbandry, a little dull. And I can't believe that you would consider getting into it as deeply as you are without having moments of exhilaration or feeling that you really are reaching a community that needs to be helped, that you want to help and you feel you can, so that you have these special times when you can think to yourself, well, yes, I've got this far, and wasn't it fun when we did this with that? You know, you interrelate with people that otherwise you wouldn't have a chance to. And it broadens your own perspectives, which is, of course, of tremendous importance in a field such as you've decided to enter. And I was just wondering, now that you're graduating and you've had hands-on experience in several different areas, both in Arkansas and abroad, what you look back on as truly refreshing and exciting, what you hadn't quite expected it to be so fulfilling, which I hope you have had those feelings, and how you can turn that into a long-term career and maintain that excitement, curiosity, where I can help, what about this idea I had the other day, and we're speaking to so-and-so and so-and-so, so that you go growing, growing, growing the whole time?
Yeah, I mean, I think the whole experience at the Clinton School has helped me learn so much about myself on a personal level, not just on an academic or career level. And I think one of the most exciting things for me that I've learned through the school is kind of a shift in perspective in how I see ways to help people. And instead of saying, we're going to do this for someone, involving everyone in the process and having, as you mentioned earlier, multidisciplinary professionals in the area and having everyone at the table and having a conversation about what are the issues that are actually mattering to people and not what do we think those issues are. So I think that's something that is I will always have with me, regardless in whatever field I end up. I think that shift in perspective is one of the most important things mm-hmm. I've gotten from the school that I think is what excites me. Just being able to say, maybe I thought of this issue one way, but maybe I was wrong. Who didn't I listen to? Who didn't I include? Who else has a different opinion? So I think that environment is something that has helped me and that I hope to give back to others after graduating.
Do you have something similar?
Yeah, I think that I a similar takeaway. I think that the foundation upon which everything that we learn at the school is this deep understanding of not just how to fix problems, but ask why the problems are there in the first place. And to kind of humble oneself mm-hmm. to be like, yeah, okay, well, mm-hmm. you have a master's or you're getting a master's in public service. But that doesn't mean to anything to anybody who's recovering from, you know, the typhoon in the islands or outside in Bohol, you know, in the Philippines, or I'm sorry, not Bohol, but Tacloban in the Philippines. You know, that they don't care about that. And so it's a very humbling experience to realize that, yeah, your book smarts are great, but it's understanding the necessity to include everybody and make sure who isn't at the table, who's at the table, who isn't at the table, and does the table need to be somewhere else so that mm-hmm. everyone can be there. That kind of paradigm shift in mm-hmm. in service and in problem solving is kind of what everything all the other incredible skills and experience I've had were grounded in, which is, I think, what made it overall such a life-changing program.
Anne Haley and Jennifer Guzman will be with classmates receiving the University of Arkansas Masters of Public Service degrees on Sunday, May the 15th. Further details will be added later this week. Lovers of opera were enthusiastic after seeing the production of The Magic Flute presented by Opera in the Rock and the Arkansas Symphony Orchestra in the auditorium of Masonic Temple in Little Rock, January 2015. Fabulously staged with scenery provided by the temple, and talk of La Bohème next was already circulating. An ambition beyond possible, it seemed. However, this coming weekend, the impossible is achievable. all credit to Arlene Biebersheimer and her supporters. She has drawn together, within the state, an entirely Arkansas cast, an achievement in itself. From the very beginning, Philip Mann, Arkansas Symphony's music director, has been a major supporter of the project. Caught early in his career as a conductor with a love for opera from the podium. He served as music director of Oxford City Opera while he was a Rhodes Scholar in England. He is also enthusiastic about the new hall, the Pulaski Tech College's Center for Humanities and Arts. Today he is my guest, along with soprano Maria Fasciano. She and her husband, tenor Verlon DiCarlo, will be singing the roles of Mimi and Rodolfo next weekend. They are recent newcomers to Little Rock. She is a graduate of the Eastman School of Music and describes how they met.
That's actually a very operatic story in itself. He was living in New Orleans at the time, and he was a student at Loyola University in New Orleans. He's born and raised New Orleanian. And when Hurricane Katrina happened, they evacuated, his family did, maybe a week before the storm hit, because they just kind of knew it was going to be a big one. During that summer, he had been working with Stephen Daigle, who is the opera director at the Eastman School of Music. Vernon was working for him at the Ohio Light Opera, and Stephen is also a Louisiana native. And when the storm hit, he spoke with the administration at Eastman and said, I want to help. I know these young musicians. I know these two young singers, and I know a few brass players. What can we do to help them? Vernon, quite literally, came with not much more than the clothes on his back, because at that point, his family's home was under 10 feet of water. And he came to Eastman, and we were actually cast in a scenes production of Così fan tutte, and he was my Ferrando. And, you know, the minute I saw him, I just knew. That was the one. Within 2 weeks, I think, we were both pretty sure.
Philip grew up playing violin and did that professionally for quite a while, didn't you?
And just for the sake of accuracy, I grew up singing as well. I was a boy soprano and definitely had a lot of vocal training. You know, music was a constant in my household. And whether I was taking vocal lessons or singing in one of my mother's children's choirs or sitting in an orchestra conducted by my stepfather, I didn't get as much into opera until I started to study at the college level in violin, and then found myself being assistant conductor to things like a Manon Lescaut at the Spoleto Festival, or eventually then when I was in graduate school and working in England, I had the opportunity to refound the Oxford City Opera, which was actually one of the great kind of a regional opera theaters in Europe for many years, and has had the distinction of premiering several Britain productions. I'd already studied a lot of the repertoire. I knew that that was something that I really wanted to spend a lot of my time with, which led me partly to Indiana, because I was looking at the different places that I might want to continue my studies. An extraordinary opera conductor by the name of Imre Palo, who your audiences will remember that name because of his wonderful production of Kodály here and the Dvořák. And I remember the moment where I decided that this is what I needed to do, because I was in Bloomington. And actually trying to get a faculty position, and sitting, I saw on the playbill, on the marquee out in front of the concert hall there, that Bohème was being produced that evening. And as a young conductor is apt to do, you don't try to get a ticket, you walk in with the musicians, which leads you to the orchestra pit. And I befriended the stage manager, and I said, do you mind if I put a stool in the back of the orchestra pit and just and take a look? He said, we'll talk to Maestro and he'll let you know. And we struck up this great friendship. And he said, come in. By now, I'd already missed the first act. And he said, well, come in and watch the second act. And Paolo did something extraordinary that I couldn't explain. I didn't quite understand what he was able to accomplish, but I thought, I need to make my life's mission for the next couple of years to understand what I just saw.
So you saw the rest of the opera? Sitting in the wings or back in the orchestra pit?
I think I probably moved out into the house after the second act, but the second act is just this amazing... well, anyone who's seen Bohème, the second act just has a special place in their hearts. It has this wonderful joie de vivre to it, but this incredible complexity that, if handled in an organic and natural fashion, just seems like it couldn't be any other way. And yet, if you studied the score or have ever been a part of a production, it is absolute mayhem happening at the same time. And when it comes off well, it's like watching a very complicated ballet or even something like one of those great old Russian circus productions.
Will this be the first time you've sung the full role all the way through, Maria?
Yes. The role study program I did was just the role study and with a performance of excerpts. So I've had it kind of collecting dust in my brain for about 8 years. So
yes,
it'll be good to get it on its feet.
So given that, with all this background, how is this production coming together?
Well, anything as large scale as a fully staged opera production doesn't just come about overnight. So we've been talking about this naturally for quite a bit of time now. And I would say that the discussions about doing Bohème actually predate our first production together, The Magic Flute, that was so successful. We sold out the whole run. It was actually the first opportunity I had a chance to work with Maria here, where she was the first lady in flute. And there was a discussion before we mounted the Mozart opera production, what should be the very first collaboration between the ASO and opera in the rock. And we landed on the flute for various reasons, but Bohème, if we don't do Bohème first, we probably should do it as our second production. It's Puccini at his best in how he reaches out and grabs you in a way that everybody of all ages can really identify with. The success of Magic Flute really was what gave us the momentum to be able to talk about something more grand, something that costs a little bit more money, something larger in scale. It's a bigger orchestra. It's a bigger cast that you'll see on stage. We have children's chorus. We have more people coming in from out of town. And of course, that also necessitated a space that would be able to accommodate all of this. And fortuitously, the Chart Center up at Pulaski Technical College, their construction schedule aligned with our production schedule in such a way that we were able to even get in there for early musical rehearsals. So Maria could probably speak a little bit about her chance to sing in that space, which I heard her sing in the opening concert inaugurated the hall. But I can tell you that the rehearsal facilities in this space are actually quite pleasant and nice to work in. And we're looking forward to this very week getting into the hall itself, seeing what the orchestra sounds like in the pit. One never knows how that will go until you've actually heard it and experienced it. But that's show business, and that's especially opera, where you learn how to adjust to various the variables of the settings, whether it's acoustics or staging issues or all kinds of things that one looks back to the 1896 premiere with Toscanini that wasn't too successful, and you think, what? You had Toscanini, you had Teatro Reggio in Turin, and you had everything at your abilities, and probably the most enduringly popular opera in our repertoire. And I think it's things sometimes need to settle, and that's what happened with that piece as well in terms of the performance history. I was giving a lecture 2 days ago about probably one of the greatest premiere failures of all time, and you know, the question was, well, how can a piece overcome such a great failure at its premiere? And I said, well, this was the Beethoven 5th and 6th Symphony. I said, you've probably heard of them. And it helps if the piece is a masterpiece.
Really?
Really.
So now we have a question, or I have a question. This is all going on at the time while they're renovating Robinson Auditorium. And if this hall has got the acoustical quality that you say is really quite remarkable, how did that happen? Who did they use?
Oh, the acoustics of the Chart Center?
Yeah.
That's a good question. I'm not sure who it is. And, you know, I haven't heard a full production in there yet. But I can tell you that when Maria sang with a pianist, I mean, she might want to tell me a little bit about her experience there. But my sense was there was a great deal of intimacy. There was a connection with the stage where you could hear with clarity and warmth both the voice but also her accompanist. They have a nice piano in there, and the piano seemed to resonate well in the space. It's a comfortable space to hear a production, and often comfort is anathema to beauty. And it's why, you know, some churches are so wonderful, though, especially the ones without cushions on the pews. It's those wonderful resonating and reflecting hard surfaces. But in this case, I think the intimacy of the space, the size of the space, lends itself particularly well for voices.
What about the audience capacity? How big are
about 500?
It's about 500, maybe slightly more.
Yeah. What did you think when you sang there, Maria?
It's a great space. And I don't think that often theaters are built thinking, well, we're going to have an opera here. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there are many spaces I've sung in where you're getting on stage and it's, you know, it's just you can't hear, or you know, you feel like you've lost all the sound and there's, you know, it's not live. That was a really good balance between being a dry space and being live.
You know, one of the things that was fun for us to see for the first time was the actual space in the Center for the Humanities and the Arts. From my standpoint, the orchestra pit is much larger than I would have expected in a hall that size, which was tremendously, it was just a wonderful, pleasant surprise. They had the foresight to think about other types of productions, whether it was ballet, music theater, opera. And I think the versatility of that space is actually a great addition to our community, where we have a kind of somewhat of a paucity of performance spaces. And for those of your listeners that are wondering about the Robinson Auditorium, you referenced the new hall as part of the Robinson's renovation. I'm thrilled to announce that we have a dramatically expanded orchestra pit there as well. I think the previous pit accommodated about 32 to 35 musicians, and we have a pit that'll fit over 70 musicians. So you could mount a Wagner opera if you really so chose to do so.
What about the hall in North Little Rock? How big an orchestra can you fit in that one?
I think about 35, maybe something like that. It's large enough for us to really have all the parts covered, to have a string section that will allow us to hear that just voluptuous and extraordinary orchestration of Puccini. It allows us to have percussion and timpani and things like that in the pit. And when you're talking about one of the great orchestrators of all time, he's such a – Puccini, because he's not known to orchestra audiences as much, one doesn't know the scores as well as a listener, but they are just sublime. He has an amazing ability to voice chords in exactly the right way, which of course you'd expect for somebody who knows how to voice – to write up for the voice, but to do it in such a way that you can have power and emotion and gravitas behind something that could even be pianissimo from the singer at the same time. There are very few people who can do that. And I'm always astonished when I open up a Puccini score of the genius of it. I mean, you're off and running with this opera, and one of the distinctive factors to me is that it begins as if there's no introduction. You're just flying into it, and from that point forward, there is almost no moment of real musical repose. There may be a relaxation. There may be different amounts of tension or anxiety or of calmness, but there isn't a single moment in this opera where you can really take yourself out of the music, because it is so gripping, so enduringly powerful, so interesting. Mm-hmm. And Bohème, while it's not a very long opera in the first place, it can feel like it's half an hour long when it's at its best. Mm-hmm. I'm really excited for Arkansas audiences to follow up on the flute success with a grand Italian opera. This really sets us up for expectations for the future. I think fully staged opera is back in Arkansas, and it's back in style.
Philip Mann, the ASO music director, conductor, and soprano Maria Fasciano, Mimi in the production. Philip Mann will be conducting the 7:30 Friday, 13th of May performance of Puccini's opera La Bohème, the first of two performances. The second at 3 p.m. on Sunday, May the 15th, Jeffrey Robson, the ASO's associate conductor, will be on the podium. This fully staged production will open the brand new stage of Pulaski Tech College's Center for Humanities and Arts, 3000 Scenic Drive, North Little Rock. For tickets, call the box office, 501-812-2338, open 9 a.m. to 5 p.m., Monday through Friday, or online visit www.oitr.org. And that concludes this week's program. Please join us next weekend at the same time. I'm Ann Nicholson. Thank you for listening.
The Art Scene is a presentation of UALR Public Radio.